Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to be with you today, but I'm going to be on a telephone because we're doing a lot of filming, and I can't be on my regular Zoom film this morning. However, we have a lot of positive information and a lot of new information to share with you. For example, on health and healing from Green Med Info, Satterchi, who does a lot of good work, by the way, the real benefits of lemon water according to real science. Now, keep in mind, I've been suggesting for years, decades, that you have lemon water each morning. Now, you can add something to it. You can put some ginger into it, some green apple into it, celery into it, and all that merely makes it even better. But this morning, for example, I went out to the tree and I picked some lemons up off the ground. I always let the fruit fall to the ground, and then I pick it up the next day, because that's the ripest fruit. That's the best fruit, tastiest fruit. Bring it in, wash it off, cut it. And by the way, after I cut any citrus or anything for that matter, avocado or anything, I wash the surface area, because when you use a knife and you cut through the skin, then if there's any contamination on the skin, it's now smeared over the flesh. So let's say I wash my avocado thoroughly. I wash the knife blade. I peel the avocado. I wash the peeled avocado. Then it's safe. You have no idea how many Americans each year develop food poisoning because something was left out too long, a bacterial infection, something wasn't really washed thoroughly. And that's why I don't care if it says it's triple washed. I go ahead and wash it again the proper way so you don't get food poisoning. In any case, so same way as the citrus, wash it, cut it, wash the top of it, juice it. But then this morning I put in a tablespoon of elderberry concentrate. Why? Because right now there's all forms of viruses going around that generally affect the upper respiratory tract and the lungs, the sinuses. Some are flu, some are cold, some are COVID of the variants. And so this way it protects all that, because elderberry concentrate is one of the most powerful immune stimulants you can take in. But you have to read carefully if you're ordering online, because you can also get elderberry, but it's in a tincture, and it's 30% alcohol. You don't want that. You want the pure, unadulterated concentrate. So you're getting a lot. So a tablespoon of that went into my lemon juice. I used the juice of about 4 lemons. And then I used some celery juice, and I also used some coconut water to fill up the whole 16-ounce glass. It's always best to have this first thing in the morning when you get up. Why? Well, Sarah G has done the research for us here, and he talks about lemons. Now, we already know that lemons originated from India, and especially around the Himalayan foothills, and then spread from there. And historically, there were two types of lemons, the Lisbon, L-I-S-B-O-N, and the Eureka, E-U-R-E-K-A. But there's other types of lemon. I grow Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R lemons. They're a sweeter lemon. And the fruit is lower in calories. It only has 29 calories per 100 grams, so it's virtually nothing. But it's a good source of vitamin C. I mean, a really good source. A single lemon contains about 30 to 40 milligrams of vitamin C. In comparison to an average orange, which contains somewhere between 80 and 90 milligrams of vitamin C. So when you have your lemon water in the morning, one of the things it does, it helps detoxify and cleanse. This is the first benefit that comes to mind when it comes to lemon water. Not surprisingly, the amount of urine is increased when drinking lemon water. However, lemon water brings with it the primary compound known as citrate, C-I-T-R-A-T-E. Now, this is a naturally occurring inhibitor of toxins, which can build up in the form of crystals in the body, lactic acid crystals. And the citric acid enhances your body's ability to naturally flush out these unwanted toxins. As published by Dutch researchers in the European Journal of Nutrition, lemon peels and the waste stream of the lemon peels are effective in lowering blood and liver cholesterol levels. As published in Indian Researchers Journal, the British Medical Journal of Pharmacology, 2005, hesperidin, H-E-S-P-E-R-I-D-I-N, that's a citrus bioflavonoid found in lemons, demonstrates the ability to protect the liver from damage. After administering CC4, a well-known liver toxin, the authors concluded that hesperidin demonstrates a protective effect on the liver. These studies shed light on the lemon's ability to enhance the liver's function of filtering out unwanted toxins. Do I believe that every person receiving chemotherapy, which is toxic to the liver, should have lemon water? You bet. Now, next, it improves digestion. Citrus bioflavonoids, or what are called flavonoids, are the primary cause of improved digestion when drinking warm, not cold, warm lemon water. They aid in the assimilation of food, help prevent fatty liver and disease, and decrease the chance of cardiovascular disease, fat lowering, and reduce insulin sensitivity. So that's important. Now, also, the citrus bioflavonoids act as a great digestive tonic. It helps suppress the appetite in those that tend to overeat, and it also helps calm an upset stomach or mild indigestion. So if you eat too much, if you ate the wrong combination of foods, fine. Take a little bit of warm lemon water with fennel and anise seeds and powder in it. It'll help. And this has to do with the hydrochloric acid in your stomach that start the process of breaking down your food. It's believed that citrus bioflavonoids and lemon water support the hydrochloric acid in the stomach. Now, also, it improves the good bacteria in your gut. It alkalizes your system. If you're new to the concept of alkalinity, it's the process of neutralizing acid in the body. The basic idea is your body has certain acids that can build up, causing negative side effects, such as acid reflux and upset stomach and acidosis. And an ideal range to fall between 4.6 and 8.0 and can be tested with pH strips using saliva or urine. Lemon water is a safe and effective way to manage your pH levels, and achieving healthy alkalinity can benefit your bone health, reduce muscle wasting, decrease chance of hypertension, high blood pressure, and strokes, and improve cardiovascular health and improve memory. It also can help reduce wrinkles and improve skin. And you have to drink the lemon water every day, but also you can apply it topically. Lemons have been found to be high in antioxidants, which are linked to anti-aging properties. The primary cause of aging comes from free radicals that cause the breakdown of various tissues in the body, namely skin. And research showed that plant-derived antioxidants were able to reverse the breakdown of collagen fibers in the skin. Hence, a healthy plant-based diet and juicing and lemon water can benefit. It also has essential oils. So the oils in the lemon peel are very beneficial for you. In fact, one of the most interesting parts is linked to the oil that has antimicrobial activities against bad bacteria, yeast, and fungi, such as Candida albicans. You might know it as just a yeast infection or Candida infection. In a study performed by the Central Food Technology Research Institute, they looked at how what is called geraniol, G-E-R-A-N-I-O-L, which is a phytonutrient found in lemons, aided in reversing diabetic neuropathy. That's a big deal. The study showed that sciatic nerve damage was reduced through lemon oil. Again, that's the geraniol. In the full 8-week study, cellular function was restored, suggesting that the use of lemon oil regularly assists in regulating energy stores. So, those are just some of the real, not all, there's a lot more on lemons, but that just shows you why you should be having lemons and lemon water, warm lemon water, and you can add to it anything else that you feel is beneficial in the morning. From Harvard School of Public Health comes a study about the variety of healthy eating patterns is linked to a low risk of premature death. What's that mean? According to Harvard School of Public Health, and this is important, this was a part of the Dietary Guidelines of America study, a variety of healthy eating patterns are linked to reduced risk of premature death. And they found that participants who scored high on adherence to at least one of four healthy eating patterns were less likely to die during the study period from any cause and less likely to die from cardiovascular disease, cancer, or respiratory distress compared with people on lower scores. Now, few studies have evaluated whether greater adherence to the recommended dietary patterns is associated with long-term risk of total cause-specific death. The researchers used health data collected over 36 years from 75,000 women participating in the Nurses Health Study and 44,000 men in the Professional Doctor Study. All the participants were free of cardiovascular disease or cancer at the beginning of the study and completed dietary questionnaires every 4 years. And then it was scored based upon what they ate or didn't eat. And they found that those who had whole grains, fruits, and vegetables, and nuts, and legumes had substantial improvements, higher scores. And that meant longer lives. That meant less disease. That's all good. And by the way, we are now in the process of writing up over the next week the final results of the study, submit for peer review. And my hope is that someday this week, the university will give us the very comprehensive and, I must tell you, very complicated understanding of the DNA methylation test that we all took in the last study in April. But I'm confident that that this will come in shortly. I was given a promise from the director of the institute it's going to come, and we can be setting some scientific history if it does. And if that's the case, then I'll do two studies. I'll do one with a new protocol that I've come up with, and because I don't have to follow their protocol, I want to expand on it. And some people can even do this from their own home. And this will be a long-term study. This will be a one-year study that you can do from home. But I'm not going to discuss that at this point. I have to get all the results in and see what we can actually say we proved versus not. So mind you, the studies that you're looking at are non-specific. If you take 100,000 nurses and physicians and you follow them over 36 years, and then you see who got sick and who didn't, and then they tell you, well, this is primarily my diet, but here's what you don't know. You don't know if there was anything in their lifestyle that was very stressful or toxic environments or working long hours or working around radiation equipment or any form of electromagnetic pulse. You don't know that. You don't know if they were also having primarily healthy foods but a lot of junk foods as well, and I see a lot of people do that. We don't know how much alcohol they drank. And because frequently when people are just drinking wine, we say, well, wine is good for you, and that's not true. A resveratrol, which you find in wine, is good, but you'd have to drink a case of resveratrol, and hence a lot of alcohol and a lot of sulfates, which are very toxic to your lungs in particular, to get what you can by just having one 200 milligram capsule of resveratrol. You don't know how much stress these people are under. You don't know how they responded to losses in their life. And because that can increase, a loss can increase the grieving process for a long period of time. And that means that your cortisol levels are on five-alarm fire 24/7. That really prematurely ages because it creates a massive amount of free radicals in the form of oxidative stress. So these are the things you don't know when you do a study like this. It's all based upon surveys and keeping diaries and then saying, no, I didn't get cancer, no, I didn't get heart disease. But what were the things you might have had? Were you at normal weight? How much exercise did you do each day? What was your body mass index? So So that's what they don't do in these studies, but these are still considered really important studies. And I would agree they give us a good indication. But what I do is I do really specific studies where we have to interview every single person. We have to know everything about their medical and health backgrounds and their diet and their lifestyle. All that is taken into consideration. Then we put them in an enclosed environment, meaning we have them all at the same location so they can't cheat. So everyone's taking the same supplements, everyone's eating the same food, same number of juices, same exercises, just different intensities, same nature time, and meditation classes, yoga classes. So then we have a really, really tightly controlled study. These are very difficult, very expensive to do, and I can only afford to do maybe one, most two a year, because that just takes an enormous amount of effort. But if you get good results, if you're breaking through barriers that no one has done before, then I believe it's worth it. So now we're just waiting to see what were the results. I'll share all of that with you as soon as we get them published. Now, from Harvard University again comes an article published in the Journal of Urology. Improved prostate cancer survival found among men who use zinc supplements. That's good news. Let me quote directly. Quote, biological and experimental evidence support restoration of normal zinc levels in malignant prostate cells as a promising prophylactic cancer treatment. Yet the influence of zinc after diagnosis on prostate cancer survival in the human population is unknown. All right. Quote, few studies have investigated post-diagnosis zinc supplementation in prostate cancer survival in the human population. But this one did. They investigated 5,788 men diagnosed with non-metastatic prostate cancer who enrolled in the health professionals follow-up study. And 15% of the men reported using zinc supplements after their diagnosis. During an 11-year medium follow-up, 3,198 deaths occurred among those 5,788, and among which 527 deaths were caused by prostate cancer. Men who reported using zinc supplementation after being diagnosed with prostate cancer had an 18% lower risk of dying from the disease and a significant 16% lower risk of dying from any cause in comparison to men who did not use zinc. In fact, there was a 45% lower risk of dying from prostate cancer and a 23% lower risk of dying from all-cause diseases among men who used low-dose zinc. That would be like 15 milligrams. Now, just imagine. So they're saying, yes, you know, men who use zinc survived at a high percentage. But what if they also used Africanum pygium and bioflavonoids? There are at least 20 different nutrients that are shown to interfere in the prostate cancer pathogenesis process. And that's just one nutrient. And I don't even see from the study what form the zinc was in, because not all zinc is absorbed the same. So, but still, even just plain old zinc made a difference. That's good news. Also, from the University of Copenhagen comes a study that vitamin D improves immune response to tuberculosis. That's really good news, because worldwide, 2 billion people globally suffer from tuberculosis, and 1.5 million people worldwide die from it each year. But according to the peer-reviewed journal Frontiers in Immunology, vitamin D3 can help the immune system fight tuberculosis. Quote, for the first time we have shown that vitamin D improves the immune system's ability to fight the tuberculosis bacterium, Mycobacterium tuberculosis, end quote. That's the Professor Wiseman from the Foundation on Skin Immunology Research Center at the University of Copenhagen. Again, good news. That's the latest on health and healing. I want to thank you all for taking the time to listen to our program today. Again, I'm on a telephone. We are just in the last day of finishing filming a brand new documentary, and I'm doing introductions, filming it, and one last person we're filming, and that one we're hoping to bring to New York to premiere when I have another brand new film that we're finishing post-editing, that we're gonna bring two films, brand new, you haven't even heard of, hard-hitting, to New York. One's very upbeat and positive and can save lives. The other is a real expose, which can also save lives. Anyhow, those are probably going to be about 2 months from now. And I'll be up in Woodstock. I'll be out in Long Island. We're going to do a double feature out in Long Island. I sent him five documentaries and said, you choose, the owner of the theater, I said, you choose which ones you feel your audience would like to see. Because my audience has any of these. I've been working nonstop doing these documentaries. But there's a reason why. Because I feel that this year will be the year when a lot of information is made available to the public that is honest, objective, very important that we know things that impact our lives, and that would be banned on the major media. So people have a chance to see a whole lot of new stuff. And we're updating new books, and old books are being updated to make them brand new, and all new information. So a whole lot's going on, and I'll let you know about that when each one becomes available. Let's take a break and come back with more information. Stay with us, please. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. I'm on a telephone, therefore we don't have the video stream today. I'll be back to that tomorrow. And so I apologize, there won't be the same technical quality as when you're talking into a microphone. But the information is still the same. And yesterday I presented a commentary on the subject of wokeism, identity politics, and critical race theory. I've written probably 20 articles, more or less, on this, and I presented them and I published them. And because I consider this what is happening now, policies being made, people having to change pronouns, or otherwise you run the risk of offending someone. In fact, particularly hard hit are professors. For example, one of my friends who listens to the program sometimes said, Gary, weren't you a little hard on the woke people? And I said, based upon what standard? I said, let me put it in a little different context. Weren't you one of the leading liberal minds in America for over 60 years? He's 85. And I said, and a real honest, true liberal, which are not represented in all that's going on with wokeism today. And I said, and weren't you attacked because you dared to say that some of these things they're doing are extreme and could lead to a backlash? Yeah. And who amongst your friends came to your side? Very few, right? Because they were afraid. Well, let's just Brett Weinstein, a tenured professor, and his wife, also a tenured professor, and at Evergreen College, outstanding reputation, and considered the most liberal professors at the college. No student in the classroom complained, but outside agitators, young people, not only complained, but they attacked him and went on a hunt for him. He had to hide. In fact, the police said that, you know, don't show up. The dean of the president of the university suggested he leave, and pressure was placed upon who agreed with the woke demonstrators that he should go. Two of them should go, even though they were tenured and had done nothing that represented anything that should have caused them to be challenged. But they left. Now, there was a husband and wife team at Yale University, tenured. They've been there a long time, produced a lot of good information, wrote a lot of papers, and their students like them. But once again, over something as simple as be conscious of the outfit you're wearing on Halloween that it doesn't offend anyone, that caused them to end up being canceled. So here's my question for all the others who've been canceled in any walk of life. When you stood up for what you believe was the truth, or maybe you didn't say anything, but maybe years ago you said something that today you would say, well, I was younger and not as wise as I am. And don't we all have a chance in life to make our mistakes when we're younger and become smarter as we age, go through transitions? Of course we all do. And I'm sure that everyone listening right now has said things, done things in their life that they shouldn't have, better thought through. But when you get older, you think through things. You take the time realizing there's a consequence. But for a woke person to assume that they are able to judge anyone for anything that they perceive as an insult or an effect upon anyone else is that they are perfect and they are all wise. No, they're not. But what happens when they go on a demonstration, they intimidate a university, the university then not just expels the people, asks them to leave, people who committed no crime, did nothing wrong, and now, what about those people? Do we ever stop and say, what happens to the victim? They spend a lifetime in academic studies. I'm just referring to academics now. It can be in any field. And they've achieved acceptance, they've achieved recognition, they've been respected by their peers, and suddenly, out of nowhere, someone files a Title IX on them. They don't get to know who it is, and then they're under attack. Now they lose their job. These are not rich people. Historically, they'd be considered upper middle class, that's it. But they have to work for a living. Think of the debts they have, especially if they have children. Let's say they're in their 50s, their children are going to schools, they're helping subsidize that. Well, they only have the income they have coming in order to help them pay their bills. Now they can't pay their bills. What happens to them? Nobody cares. What happened to their reputation that was perfect until they were 45, 50, 60, or 70? Nobody cares. What about all the lies that were said about them, the libel that was said about them, the slander said about them, the character assassination said about them? Nobody cares. So in other words, you can destroy people, their whole livelihood, the whole reason they have lived the way they have, and nobody cares? Well, this past Sunday, I had what might be one of the longest nonstop webinars in American history, 10 hours and 20 minutes, nonstop, and yet the vast majority of people stay clear up to the end. Ask how many people go to a concert or to a movie or to a lecture and stay for 10 and a half hours. And yet these are people from all over the world and all backgrounds, because what was being shared was information that can save lives. And I mean, it was a ton of information, more than anybody could absolutely grasp or comprehend. And we're now editing that down to a reasonable, like hopefully 3 hours of just the information on the on long COVID, on vaccine injury, helping those people. Now think of that for a moment. Every one of my guests was selected because they are amongst the most respected physicians in the world. In fact, 3 of the 7 are the most cited in the peer-reviewed literature. You don't get a higher standing of merit inside of medicine than being the most cited medical doctor in the world in your field. And yet we had them in internal medicine, we had them in cardiology, nephrology, the best of the best. 3 board certifications each. It's hard enough to get 1 board certification. They had 3 professors at major universities, published thousands of papers collectively in peer-reviewed literature, but most importantly, they've saved thousands, tens of thousands of lives. And now they've all been attacked by the new woke, where you're not allowed to criticize Fauci or vaccines or anything at all about COVID, and yet they've been right on every single thing, and the people attacking have been wrong on every single thing. So when you cancel these people, let's just say that all these people that I interviewed and all these people were courageous enough after being attacked to still keep trying to help, still trying to save lives, in spite of the fact that their incomes have been affected, their livelihoods, their reputations pillared on the front page of the New York Times. What if they would have just said enough and retired? Think of all the people who are vaccine injured in the United States, well north of 1 million, those who have long COVID, we don't know how many, and those who will develop symptoms, because it's going to take years, according to all the science I've seen, for everyone who's been adversely affected to manifest the effects. So if someone says, well, 85% of the people, you know, seem fine, no, they're not fine. It can take years for these self-organized lipids from the vaccines to grow in your arteries till they clog an artery. And we're having all these unusual deaths, and we're having all these young athletic deaths, 1,700% in 1 year. That's a huge discrepancy. We're not talking about 1 or 2%. We're talking about 1,700% of professional athletes dropping dead, or at least 60% who had the heart attacks dying. And the others still may die in spite of that, because as long as that material is in their body, it can regrow. So, what if they had retired? I wouldn't have had the ability to do this, because everything came from them, not me. So does anyone who's woke and wants to destroy someone, their reputation, without any thought or research of how important this person has been to the world, to their patients, to the cause that they have attributed all their energies? That's how flippant, that's how superficial my friend and others were thinking. They don't look at the humans who have been the victims of woke culture, identity politics, white fragility, etc., and these other asinine concepts from lunatics. They never think of what it's like. But now, what if one of those woke people's parents had side effects, and medicine is not helping anyone with the side effects because they don't know what the hell to do? They have no way of helping them. And everybody that you watch and listen to, real people with real conditions, you see them in the hospital, and the docs say, we don't know what to do. We don't know what to do. We've never seen this before. What was their parents? Well, there's some people that can help. No, I'd rather see my parents die than to be helped by someone that I've criticized and help lose their license. That's the mindset that is running rampant in every institution in America, every institution, especially in Pacifica, everywhere. So before you think that my words were too strong, they weren't strong enough. And I'm going to do more to correct that in upcoming, because I speak with the victims. I meet them. I hear their stories. I see their suffering. And yet they still have the courage and spiritual awareness to say, even though my reputation and my livelihood may be in tatters, I'm going to go out there and still help save lives. I don't see any woke people saving any lives. Nothing but hatred towards the world. And yet these are young people, more often than not, completely illiterate of the real world. And let's take a look at some of these people in depth. And that's what I intend to do. Some of the leaders. And you'll see, my God, you shouldn't be leading anything. So let's just say that all the people who've been attacked, stop helping the world. That means that millions of people from now forward will die. But what if they listened to them at the beginning? Because their patients are alive and well because they treated them from day one. Then think of all the other people in the identity politics and the right thinking mode could have gotten on board and chose not to. Think of all the deaths that could have been prevented. About 8 million. So you're going to tell me that we shouldn't speak strongly and honestly and accurately about the consequences of people who interfered in the process of Fauci and his gang causing the death of 8 million people? That's genocide. Think about that before you make another foolish argument without going into the consequence. Now, let's go to clip right now. This is a clip about a friendship. It's a friendship between a professor, Professor Syed, and his friend, Jordan Peterson. They agree on some things, they disagree upon other things. But now that Jordan Peterson has been canceled and attacked and vilified, anyone who befriends him is also to be attacked and vilified. So listen carefully to this man's words. It's very interesting. He's apologizing now to all the woke people, all the identity politics people, for having befriended Jordan Peterson. In effect, he's got to throw Jordan under the bus. He's got to spit on him. He's got to kick him in the face when he's down, looking up for a hand. No, you get a because we're young and we're wise and we're powerful. Screw with us and we'll destroy you. Here's his response. Please listen in.
Hi, everybody. This is Gad Saad. Earlier today, I put out a tweet wherein I wished my good friend Jordan Peterson happy retirement, at least when it comes to his professorship at the University of Toronto, because he left this position, and I was wishing him well on his next professional chapter in his life. And, you know, I said, march on, soldier of reason. And that drew a lot of ire from a lot of people, because Jordan Peterson is a Himmler. And so, just like Patton Oswalt, if some of you might remember, Patton Oswalt, who's a comedian, shared a photo of himself with his longstanding friend, Dave Chappelle. And then when people got angry because Dave Chappelle is a trans-genocidal monster, he then walked back his friendship and then he apologized. This is Patton, for his friendship with Dave, and he sort of showed a clip, a photo of, you know, him apologizing, writing his apology. And so I thought, you know, I took to heart all of the anger that my friendship with Jordan triggered. So I wrote a similar apology letter, because I too am very progressive. I care about the blue-haired mob. But I've done more. Look what I have. Look what I have. The whip of self-disgust. So I will be reading my apology letter, and I'll be whipping myself for having had a friendship with Jordan. You ready? Here we go. Earlier today, I wrote a tweet wishing Jordan Peterson well on his next professional journey in light of his having left his professorship at the University of Toronto. Jordan and I have been friends for many years. Oh, that takes a big whip. While I think that he is a great guy, I've recently learned that he preaches a message of personal responsibility. Being a progressive person, I realize this is an offensive message, because it is always best to blame others for your failures. Personal responsibility is akin to Nazism. I did not know that Jordan was part of a white supremacy cabal bent on erasing two-spirit people from the public sphere. Now that I know that he is a very dangerous man, as exemplified by his kindness and warmth, I will reach out to him with the hope that he will use this teachable moment to grow. I apologize for having been a friend of Jordan's. I realize that our friendship is akin to a genocide, and I accept full responsibility for having had warm feelings toward him. I was inspired to write this letter by Patton Oswalt. Patton posted a photo wherein he was posing with his longstanding friend Dave Chappelle. When the blue-haired Taliban and the Pronoun Brigade came after him, he issued an apology for having been friends with Dave. I'm doing the same here. When the woke mob comes after you, it is most noble and virtuous to throw your friends under the bus. Jordan, please join us in the progressive movement. Please accept the settled science that men too can menstruate. Please accept the settled science that men too can be pregnant. Please accept the accepted epistemological wisdom that the scientific method is tainted by white science. Please accept the settled science that we must vaccinate ourselves every Tuesday, lest we are grandma killers. Use this opportunity to grow, Jordan. To all members of the blue-haired Taliban, I apologize. I'll do better. Professor Dr. Gatsad, he, him. I apologize.
And now to one of those clarion moments. Do you remember I played clips, about 20 different clips over the last 2 years, of one of the, I believe, heir to be to run the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, finally goes to hell. But in his world, there is no hell because there's just death and you're over. But his name is Harari, Professor Harari. And he's on all the shows. He's on the shows of people who have a little bit of intellect, but not very much, and who don't think deeply and are not smart enough to challenge someone when they're giving misinformation. I've seen him on Bill Maher and other people. Well, here he is again. This is his newest one. He's at the, as you'll see in the background, some Greek forum, Greek conference in Greece, and he's there to promote the World Economic Forum. But listen carefully to what he's saying, because he's telling you exactly what they intend to do to you, and they were going to use, or they were going to weaponize the vaccine passports for health cards, which then would become credit score cards, which then become the ability to control all of your life. But he's saying, get this, and you'll hear him say it, they're definitely going to get you chipped, and then they can read your mind. And he actually states, listen carefully, don't be distracted when this is playing, because he's telling you what he thinks of you. He really doesn't like you. You're just a little mechanical element that is very susceptible to being broken, and they want to control you. You haven't voted for these people. You haven't agreed to it, but they're smart in their campaign, because I just watched their latest campaign. It's really well done. But so is all propaganda that gets your confidence. Listen to what Harari is going to do. And he equates this with Stalin, when he says Stalin can have a whole gigantic stadium of everyone smiling and clapping, but you don't know what they're really thinking. Now, with the new technology, we will absolutely know what you're thinking. We'll know if you agree with what's being said or you disagree. And then think of the consequences if you disagree, because now we have the technology through artificial intelligence to control your thoughts. And that's not the future. That's right now as we speak. So as I said, you either say, well, this isn't important. I guess not. Then again, how's that weather going out in California? Did that remind anyone? It's going to get worse over the next 2 weeks. Flooding roads, flooding homes, death. Did that get anyone's attention that maybe we should really consider, as much as it pains us, moving to a more sustainable environment? Because that's the new norm. So now the weather's going to be wet and flooding, mudslides, but it also then is going to dry and go back to fires. So between living between flooding and fires, isn't there a point to where we finally get the attention span to say, I'm in the wrong place at the wrong time for the wrong reasons, and maybe I should be more conscious of my own survival? Because the government's not going to help you and tell you to move. Because if you moved, they don't benefit from that. They don't get the property taxes. In any case, here we go with Dr. Harari.
No, I think maybe in a couple of decades, when people look back, the thing they will remember from the COVID crisis is this is the moment when everything went digital. And if this was the moment when everything became monitored, that we agreed to be surveyed all the time, not just in authoritarian machines, but even in democracies. And maybe most importantly at all, this was the moment when surveillance started going under the skin. Because really, we haven't seen anything yet. I think the big process that's happening right now in the world is hacking human beings, the ability to hack humans, to understand deeply what's happening within you, what makes you go. And for that, the most important data is not what you read and who you meet and what you buy. It's what's happening inside your body. So we had these two big revolutions, the computer science revolution or the infotech revolution and the revolution in the biological sciences. And they are still separate, but they are about to merge. They are merging around, I would say, the biometric sensor. It's the thing, it's the gadget, it's the technology that converts biological data into digital data that can be analyzed by computers. And having the ability to really monitor people under the skin, this is the biggest game changer of all. Because this is the key for getting to know people better than they know themselves. I often give the example from my own personal life that I realized I was gay only when I was 21. And I keep thinking about the time when I was 15, 16, how could I have missed it? You know, something so important about myself should have been obvious, but I didn't know. Now, today, or in 5 or 10 years, any algorithm of Microsoft or Amazon or the government would be able to know such a thing when I'm 12 or 13, just by monitoring what's happening in my body, what's happening to my eyes when I, let's say, I see a boy and a girl walking on the beach. Where do my eyes focus? So this is the crucial revolution, and COVID is critical because this is what convinces people to accept, to legitimize total biometric surveillance. If we want to stop this epidemic, we need not just to monitor people, we need to monitor what's happening under their skin, their body temperature. Like we walked in here, we had to go through a body temperature test.
Even in Israel, it has become a national security issue, right?
So again, I'm not against surveillance. It's an important tool, especially to fight epidemics. The question is, again, who is doing it and how? If you give it to the security service to do it, that's extremely dangerous. Yes, now they're using it to see whether you have the coronavirus. But exactly the same technology can determine what you think about the government. You know, anger is a biological phenomena just like disease. It's not some spiritual thing out there. It's a biological pattern in your body. With this kind of surveillance, I mean, you watch the big president, the big leader, gives a speech on television, the television could be monitoring you and knowing whether you're angry or not, just by analyzing the cues, the biological cues coming from your body. So now people are now watching us online, all over the world, this conversation. Now, maybe even right now, the people who are watching us are being watched and analyzed. And you know, the thing is, it's not just you're now watching this. The thing is, we know that you're watching this, and we also know how you feel. Are you angry about what you hear? Are you frightened? Are you bored? This is the kind of power that Stalin didn't have. You know, when Stalin gave a speech, everybody, of course, clapped their hand and smiled. Now, how do you know what they really think about Stalin? It's very difficult. You can't have a KGB agent following everybody all the time. Even if you do it, he's just watching your outside behavior. He doesn't really know what's happening in your mind. But in 10 years, the future Stalins of the 21st century, they could be watching the minds, the brains of all the population all the time. And also they will have the computing power to analyze all that. You know, it's not just having an agent following everybody all the time. The agent in Stalin's days writes a paper report, and you have these millions of paper reports piling up in Moscow. Somebody needs to read them, to analyze them. That's impossible. Now you don't need human agents. You don't need human analyzers. You just have a lot of sensors and an AI which analyzes it, and that's it. You have the worst totalitarian regime in history. And COVID is important because COVID legitimizes some of the crucial steps, even in democratic countries.
Let me repeat what he said, quote, with this kind of surveillance under the skin, you can detect a scent. I mean, you watch the big president, the big leader, give a speech on television, the television could be monitoring you and knowing whether you're angry or not just by analyzing the clues, end quote. I wonder what he would do with dissidents like myself and many others in this audience. There's no place for the dissidents in the society that the World Economic Forum has created. No place. There's no place for dissidents within the political spectrum today. And yet we should have third and fourth and fifth parties. We don't. There's no room for dissidents in the media. And hence, look at how controlled, now proven controlled, all the media was in its censorship. But that's what we're dealing with, and they're moving at lightning speed to get all this implemented. But now we're going to go to a really interesting one. This is a bombshell document that is on redacted, and I want to thank Clayton Morris and the good work he and his wife do to bring some really interesting people. This is a whistleblower, Sasha Latypova, Latypova, and listen to what she has to say. And none of us knew this. This is brand new information, but boy, does this change our perception of everything we've been told. Remember I told you every single one of the different 20 different elements that we were told were lies, and then I went through and broke down every single one to show you the truth versus the lie. You know, example, you know, the PCR test will tell you whether you're actively infected or not. That's not true. Even the developer, Dr. Harry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for developing the PCR, had an hour and 54-minute interview with me. Watch it. Go to Rumble. By the way, we can't post anything on except health information on YouTube because they'll take down the whole site. But we've moved every single thing, over 4,000 things from YouTube over to Odyssey and over to Rumble. Odyssey's got all 4,000. But Odyssey and Rumble is where you go to now, not YouTube, to get the latest information. That's honest and won't be censored. But now listen to this bombshell.
Well, to our top story now, a bombshell new report shows that the Department of Defense, yes, the Pentagon, controlled the COVID-19 program from the very beginning, and everything we were told was political theater, basically to cover it up, right down to the FDA vaccine approval process. It was all theater. That means that human beings were used as props, essentially. According to newly obtained documents, the Pentagon used a combination of shady approval authorizations that are still in use, including the PREP Act, the Emergency Use Authorization, and other transaction authority, the OTA, all of which shielded big pharma agencies, medical participants that delivered unregulated vaccines from any liability and protected them, basically. We've gone through a lot of these documents and just showed how they are not on the hook for any of this liability. These new documents were obtained by a former executive of a pharmaceutical contract research organization. That person is Sasha Latypova, and Sasha joins us now to tell us what she's uncovered. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Sasha.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. This is intense. I mean, when you first uncovered these documents, did your jaw just hit the floor, or did you know that this is what you were going to find based on the breadcrumbs you were already uncovering?
I was really shocked. I was working on this for quite some time. My first finding was that these products were not good manufacturing practice compliant. And that I found right away when they started being rolled out due to extreme variability of adverse events and deaths that were reported per each lot of the so-called vaccine. So that was very shocking to me as a pharmaceutical professional, because we know how high quality pharmaceuticals typically must be manufactured. You know, they have to be very, very consistent. There should be practically no variation lot to lot in terms of toxicities or any other performance characteristics. And these products were varying about 1,000 times lot to lot. So that was extremely concerning. And I didn't realize why that was happening, but I just knew that they were not good manufacturing practice compliant. I later confirmed that through regulatory documents. And then the final piece of the puzzle was when I was able to see all these contracts from the DoD. They were released based on Freedom of Information requests and also Securities and Exchange Commission disclosures. And when I saw those contracts, there were around 400 that are now available for all COVID, so-called COVID countermeasures, including vaccines. I realized that was really what was going on. The Department of Defense used a very shady contracting practices and also used several laws that were put in place previous to COVID to do this, to shield pharmaceutical companies, to not conduct proper clinical trials, to do a lot of fraudulent, I would say, manipulations of public perception, and all in collusion, obviously, with mainstream media and these pharma companies. And so as a result, we have this theatrical performance called clinical trials, but they were actually not real. They did not, based on the laws that are used here and invoked in this process, the clinical trials are not required at all. And in fact, they cannot be conducted.
I mean, there's many really troubling parts of the story. We'll unpack a few of them, but that one stands out to me perhaps at the top of the list is the theatrics that were put in place for these trials. So there were human beings in many ways being used as props to paint the veneer that they were somehow going through deep trials to make sure that we were all safe with these vaccines. And you have, I know there was a, for instance, a 13-year-old girl. They in fact had an ad, the Vaccine Safety Council had put out an ad that was going to run during the Super Bowl. Then it was yanked by Comcast. They wouldn't allow it to air, which shows a perfectly healthy 13-year-old girl who went through this particular trial and then ended up having all sorts of adverse events. So these people were used as props, essentially, right?
Yes, exactly. And so the clinical trial subjects were deceived. But importantly, most of the clinical trial sites and investigators were also deceived. And most of the FDA employees were deceived because this particular scam is driven from the top. Only few people, as far as I understand, at the top of these organizations, the Department of Defense, HHS, FDA, BARDA, their legal counsels, they know. But then the rest of the regular employees and rank and file, and especially clinical trial subjects, of course, were kept in the dark. And in fact, under Obama administration Cures Act, amended, I believe, the emergency use authorization, or the, not emergency, the informed consent requirements, such that subjects don't have to be necessarily informed of what's going on if it's deemed not in their best interest. And so again, through it's too long to go into the legal history. There is very extensive research, hundreds of pages of documents on legal history of this, but the laws that they're invoking to run this program do not require informed consent, and also do not require the clinical trials.
So the people,
and they're not under FDA.
I'm sorry, this is unbelievable. So the people involved in these trials, they don't need to be informed about what is happening?
Yes, exactly. So the informed consent rules have been amended under Obama to say that if it's not in the best interest of the subject, who decides if it isn't? But that's what it says. So, these types of things can be concealed from people, that this actually under emergency use authorization used during public health emergency. This is very critical. That's why they keep extending public health emergency beyond any, we don't have any emergency, but they keep extending it. Why? Because they need this. Under public health emergency, emergency use authorized these kinds of medications, countermeasures, that's a key word. These are not vaccines, they're countermeasures. So all these three together, they can use it this way. They don't have to inform the subjects what it is. They can use a lot of secrecy. They don't have to run clinical trials. They're not required because these products cannot be investigational products. That's what the law says. If they cannot be investigational products, then we don't have any investigation. We don't have any clinical trial subjects. So that's how they're pulling this off.
So it's at the Pentagon. It's at the Department of Defense. You talked about countermeasures. And of course, I think what we all think of immediately is foreign threat, right? That this is you're dealing with the Pentagon, right? It's supposed to protect us against foreign adversaries. So how is COVID a foreign adversary? And how is this being run through the Pentagon?
That's a great question. So from the very beginning, turns out that the Trump administration and subsequently Biden administration treated this COVID as war, as an act of war. Because the National Security Council is setting COVID response policy, which is National Security Council doesn't have any health department representatives, only defense and intelligence. And so so National Security Council sets policy for COVID. HHS is not setting policy. HHS is not lead agency in response of it. They're managing information. So the top of the government is treating it as an act of war. And they're telling all of us, oh, it's a health event. It's a naturally evolved virus, jumped from a bat. And don't even mention, lab creation, because you'll be canceled on social media immediately and censored, right? So right from the start, we have huge deception going on. What in fact they're treating as war, they're telling people it's a health event.
And we learned from the... And we learned from the Twitter files, Sasha, just this past week, the latest round of Twitter files, that the Biden administration was actively going after and trying to censor anybody who talked about lab leak theories and talked about Wuhan lab. And we're going after this idea that this came from a bat, came out of a lab. And so they were actively trying to censor that narrative. So this was all coordinated. And we know that multiple agencies were actively, of course, going after Twitter and social media companies and trying to keep this quiet. In these documents, does your research show, I mean, just how deeply does this go? I mean, how widespread is the Pentagon's tentacles in this? Does it reach to Dr. Fauci? Does it reach to other main agencies?
Well, yes. So they're all in fact coordinating this. In fact, there is, they even set up in 2013. So by the way, the pre-planning goes years, at least 2012, 2013, based on the contracts and based on the documents that I have uncovered. So for example, there is Pandemic Enterprise. It's a quasi-private, quasi-government enterprise that's been set up in 2013 that involves 10 heads of federal agencies.
Well, that's our program for today. I want to take just a second to say thank you all very much, because we do not advertise, we don't have presence in social media as such, but a lot of people are sharing the information. If you go to GaryNall.com, you can share the videos, you can share the articles, the original investigations, the commentaries. And I want to thank, according to Rodney, I want to thank 5,100,000 downloads and live listens to my show over the last year. Thank you very much. And also tomorrow, I'll be giving you places around the world that listen to the show. We're talking about countries with lots of listeners all over the world. I think you'll find that of interest. That's why I select topics and share information based upon what people would need to know or want to know in other countries. So thank you all very much. Keep sharing the information, and have a nice day.